It's even more important to have a teaching learning attitude remotely. If you're local, that's much easier to do. It takes more of a concerted effort to do that if you're remote.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Let's get to the real work. Hey everyone, I'm Jack Hanna, your host. And today we're talking with Kent Beck. If folks don't know Kent, you are a software engineer. You're one of the original signers of the Agile Manifesto, a creator of JUnit, author of the Extreme Programming book series, among others, and author of the Tidy First newsletter. Above all, to me at least, you're a deep thinker about software development practices, human relationships, and a number of other topics. So we're really excited to have you on today.
Jack, it's a pleasure to be here.
The place that I want to start, Kent, is your personal mission statement and the first two lines of the description of your newsletter. Your personal mission statement, if I have it right, is to help geeks feel safe in the world.
Correct.
And your newsletter description, the Tidy First newsletter description, is that software design is an exercise in human relationships. So are all the other techniques we use to develop software. Could you start by explaining what each of these mean?
Sure. So the mission statement came probably 20 years into my career when I thought, I've done a variety of things that don't seem to have any thread. What's the thread besides coming out of my brain that ties these together? And it took a week of thinking and walking and milking goats, and the phrase popped into my head, I help geeks feel safe in the world. And what that means to me is that first word, help, I'm not making anybody anything, but I want to make it possible for some of the anxiety that geeks tend to feel for all of us to manage it better. And, you know, this is, starts with me. I tend to be an anxious person. And by geek, I like G-Paw Hill's definition. A geek is someone who's highly technical, highly creative, and highly desirous of being both. And so there's lots of different kinds of geeks, but the people who tend to dive deeply into topics, anxiety often comes along with that. I was at a Christmas party. I did not feel safe. I was, in fact, entirely safe.
I bet.
Nobody was going to do anything to me, but I'm just like on high alert, you know, and that's a moment when I am safe and I feel unsafe. There's a flip side where people YOLO, you know, changes to production and break software for a billion people, and they feel entirely safe, even though their behavior is completely unsafe. I would like them to change their behavior so that their feeling matches the reality of the situation. In that case, it's changing the reality of the situation, not changing how you cope with 30 tipsy people with a Christmas tree in the corner.
Sure.
So that's the mission statement. The things I've done, whether it's patterns or TDD or JUnit or extreme programming, all create context where it's easier to feel safer. You know, this phrase psychological safety is getting a lot of play, but there's very little about how you create it. And it's not about the lack of conflict. It's about trusting to the resolution of the conflicts that do arise. But how do you do that as a geek? You know, it's really easy to get focused on, this is my thing. I'm really this thing. I am my code. If someone criticizes my code, they're criticizing me. I feel terrible. That's another one of those. In fact, you are safe and you feel unsafe. And yeah, there's some growing up to do to learn how to better deal with that situation. So that's the mission statement. I spent 16 years researching software design. From a panel in 2005 I was on about the book Structured Design that Larry Constantine and Ed Yordan, blessed memory, published, that introduced the terms coupling and cohesion. So I'd spent all this time, I felt like I could do it, but I couldn't really explain it. And I tried and tried and tried and tried a bunch of different things. And it took me 15 years to come to a reasonable explanation of it. And that's what Tidy First, that I published last year, was about. I published an executive briefing on that called The Good News Factory that's on O'Reilly now. And next year I'll be publishing a follow-up book called Tidy Together about exactly this teamwork. So I'd done all this research on software design, and I sat down to write the book, and the first words off of my fingers were, software design is an exercise in human relationships. I thought, no, that's not what I'm talking about. You know, coupling and cohesion and Pareto distributions and, you know, large changes in small safe steps. And that's what software design is about. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized, oh, no. As a software designer, if I were looking at our code and I think, Jack, our code really should be designed like this, and you don't see it, we have a relationship problem. We don't have a technical problem. It's not like, oh, my idea is better than yours. I mean, it might be, it might not be, but fundamentally, we have a relationship problem. And if I treat that as a technical problem, I'm just forever going to be frustrated. Like,
I have these good ideas and nobody will listen to me.
Well, that's because you're not paying attention to the relationships. And if you're a geeky person who isn't naturally good at relationships, you're going to have to work at it. So there's a sense in which Tidy First and the follow-ups is very much an extension of that personal mission statement. And there's another sense in which I'm dealing with a specific, very technical topic. Being good at software design isn't just about relationships. This is about being good at designing the software in a community.
A system of people.
Yeah. You know, and if I cause you to have to do some work, I need to make up for that somehow. You know, if I just say, oh, well, this is the new API and you have to change your code, you're like, no, I'm not going to do that. And again, we have a relationship problem. It doesn't matter whether the new API is better than the old API.
Yeah.
What matters is that we have a relationship problem and I need to take responsibility to match the authority, to align with the authority that I've taken by making my change.
Well, you shared that this is a topic that you've struggled with or is something that you've needed to work on personally. Do you have any specific examples that you can share of situations where you really faced this challenge head on?
Oh, my whole time at Facebook. Facebook had some world-class talent, fantastic infrastructure, and there was opportunities for improvement. But I had zero impact on Facebook's infrastructure because I didn't know how to get people on side. And quite the opposite, oftentimes. I would accidentally just piss people off over and over again to the point that I was getting banned from groups. And, you know, I would look at what I'd posted. I'm like, nothing wrong with what I said. Well,
well, yeah. What's an example of that, though?
So we used MySQL, and in particular, InnoDB is the back end for the distributed graph database. You know, the social graph actually a database with nodes and edges. And I looked at it and I thought, this is overkill. There's a whole bunch of functionality there. I had a student, I was doing a lot of coaching at the time. I had a student who was working on InnoDB internals. And I'm looking at this C code and I'm just thinking, man, this is way more functionality than we need. We're using a tiny little sliver of this. Why don't we just build a database that is that tiny sliver that we need since we don't need everything? And I set it in. Again, I'm going to fall back on that classic geek defense.
But I wasn't wrong.
You know, and that's exactly where I want to go. But I didn't build any credibility. I didn't build any relationships outside of work. I didn't know any of the people whose expertise I was going to be challenging in any kind of way. We hadn't worked together on anything. They had no reason to trust me. Then they didn't. I was going to say politely. I was asked to stay out of those discussions.
And that prevented you from having the impact it sounded like you wanted to have.
Later on, somebody did things right and discovered, oh, yes, a much simpler database is plenty for what we need and you know, gives us 10% performance improvement, you know, which across 100,000 servers is a lot of money. But they got it and I didn't. And it was entirely about how I managed or didn't manage the relationships involved. Would it have been easy? Oh, hell no. Technically not. Relationship-wise, not. But I didn't have any impact, and I could have.
Yeah. So you touched on some of the things that you didn't do. Let's talk about what good looks like. Like, how do you go about approaching a change like that? Be it in person, remote, or otherwise. We'll talk about the remote stuff, the remote version of this in a minute. But you're in a situation like that. You're a geek. You've got this idea for a better way to do a thing that other folks are doing. But maybe you're not day-to-day involved in that thing. So you don't have the trust, the credibility, all the context-relevant history that everybody else has in the project. How do you go about making a suggestion such that it's actually heard?
Well, 6 months of apprenticeship wouldn't have hurt me any. Just, all right, so what are the current problems with the current system? How can I contribute to that? Let me go fix a bug or improve the documentation or dig into a performance problem or really dig into some nasty bug that nobody, you know, infrequent bug that nobody has time for. Doing kind of carry water, mop the floor kind of tasks, that demonstrates you're not coming in hot. You're not coming in, I'm so cool, and you're not. It's like, oh, no, this person knows what they're talking about. They've established ethos, credibility. Also, people feel good about you because you've been helping them do their stuff. And from that context, you can say, boy, it seems like this is overkill. Over the weekend, I went and built this little prototype and, you know, 80% done is 20% done. But please explain to me, what am I missing from this prototype? But that would have required that I, you know, stuff my ego in a sack and not think like, oh, I got a great idea.
That feels a little slow for a meritocratic
compared to what? Not having any impact at all? So the one alternative to that is in an emergency situation. Okay. You can grab the wheel if you're about to go over the cliff. But this wasn't an emergency situation. This was, you know, we'd already scaled to whatever, a billion users, and things were going okay. And yeah, people would like more efficiency, but it wasn't a crisis situation. So that kind of crisis intervention was just not going to be, why? If I reverse the roles, yeah, I tell myself to go jump also.
It's a good reminder, I think, in particular, because most situations aren't emergency situations, I don't think, at least. If you take the time to take a step back, you can sort of see the forest through the trees. But I think the message here that I'm taking from this is that before you go in making suggestions about a situation you're not directly involved in, take the time to get to know the people, the problems in the space. Make some of your own contributions to the things the people already involved care most about, even if it's not the thing you want to make a suggestion on, before you then go out and make that suggestion. Because that earns the credibility, it builds the relationships, and it helps you understand the context so that when you go to make that suggestion, it can be heard in a way that's actually digested. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So this came up in the early days of extreme programming. People would say, well, I'd love to do this extreme programming stuff. How do I get the go-ahead to do it? Well, if you go into an organization and you prove that you're a better waterfall programmer than anybody else there, and then you say, and there's something even better, people are more likely to listen to you. There'll still be resistance and egos and defensiveness and whatever, but you have a much more solid base. But again, oh, that's too slow compared to all of the people who started up little enclaves of extreme programming and then everybody got fired. That's pretty slow too.
That's a useful reminder that even if it feels slow, the alternative very well may be nothing changes.
Correct.
So I want to talk a little bit about remote work specifically because it's what we do here on the podcast.
What?
So, you know, Kent, I'm gonna make you talk about it because some of the things that we're talking about, building relationships with other people, taking the time to get to know these spaces, they do feel a little bit different. How do you feel about the industry's initial push towards remote and in some cases retraction from it with return to work?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and you're not going to get straight answers from people. The big bosses demanding return to office right now, whose needs are being really met there? Nobody's going to be honest about the answer to that. Personally, I love going into the office with my team every day, seeing people, drinking coffee. When I was at Gusto, we had this kind of odd ritual every morning. A group of us would gather around coffee. And then one day somebody came walking up to walk past us and we were kind of lined up on either side of a walkway. And so we just sort of spontaneously went, woo! And then everybody else who walked by, we gave them the woo! And everybody's like, oh, that feels great. That's just awesome. You know, that's just not going to happen remote.
Well, it's that transition from person to worker. Right?
Yeah. Yes. So that's how I think about it is my oldest Beth and I have been working on kind of the next generation methodologies sort of thinking. And one of the threads that comes into that is Wiccan and the idea of the magic circle. So you enter the circle and you give up some things and you gain some things. And then you very deliberately leave the circle and you set down the things that happen in the circle and you pick up the things that happen outside the circle. And that's true every day. And that's much easier to do with an office every day, especially if you've got crazy ass people going, woo, as you walk through the door.
Sure.
The same's true of week to week. Like every Monday, there should be a magic circle. And you're like, all right, well, I had, how'd everybody's weekend go? How we feeling? All right, we're ready to set down the me or the family and pick up the colleague. We're trying to achieve something together here. Sometimes it'll be joyful. Sometimes it'll be stressful. It's fine. We're here for each other for this period of time in this place. Now, last team that I managed was fully remote. And we had a bunch of that feeling in spite of that. We had daily rituals. We had weekly rituals. We had a quarterly ritual. We were submitting tax payments to state tax authorities. And that's always, there's last minute crushes and new bugs, because you only run this code once a quarter. And so we would get together once a quarter physically for that filing week. And that really cemented that teamwork. I think sometime face-to-face, a couple, three times a year at least, is really essential. The kind of open source model where you just have a bunch of people in scattered about, never see each other, like it can work. There's some things that doesn't meet my needs socially. It's a trade-off. I really miss the office. I do almost all of my work here at home. I'm a content producer now, whatever that means.
Sure.
I write and I speak.
Right.
And I make art. And yeah, it feels lonely sometimes.
Well, I want to actually come back, if I can interrupt, to some of those daily, weekly, and quarterly rituals you described that you had at Gusto, maybe starting with daily and weekly, because hopefully it's stuff that folks can think about implementing or considering for their own work.
Yeah. So the daily, we were scattered across time zones, East Coast to West Coast, which I would at least consider aligning teams longitudinally, which we had at Mechanical Orchard, where you're in a stripe and you can have people in South America if they're on the same time zone. But we would have a 2-hour team time every day, two sessions of 2 hours, where everybody was just expected to be there. And sometimes the, you know, there'd be a conversation about what happened yesterday and what do we need to do today? And then people would pair off from there. And then if people did work before, that's fine. If people did work after, that's fine. But that's a kind of, if I was in office, yeah, everybody should show up at about the same time. That's part of the sacrifice you make. But you, same thing is, I think, more true remote. Everybody shows up at the same time. As a matter of policy, you don't accept meetings that interrupt those. You know, if there's something once in a while, it's fine. But you wouldn't ever accept a repeating meeting that interfered with team time. That just didn't happen. So that's that was the daily circle rhythm. Team time started, you'd be there, you're entering that circle. You're saying, yeah, we're working together. We don't know. I don't know who I'm working with. I don't know exactly what I'm working on, but I don't care. We're in this together and we'll do something good. The weekly ritual, Monday, first question is, what's the most important thing for us to work on this week? So backlog, who cares? There's stuff we're working on and then there's a whole bunch of stuff we're not working on. So what's the most important thing for us to work on this week? And we had these looming deadlines. You know, we would be implementing a new state tax agency and it had to be done by May 1st. So made it easier to prioritize. Then people would sign up for no more than half of what they thought they could accomplish out of the things to do. And then Friday, we had a fantastic support from product, which included the people who were actually filing taxes. You know, that's a specialist activity. And we had a former tax filer full-time on our team. And the manager of the tax filers would regularly meet with us on Mondays just to find out what's going on. And it was fantastic. And then Friday, demo, how'd things go? What do we want to do different? Exit the circle.
And that's like end of day Friday?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, noon, noonish, after lunch, whatever, something like that. So the East Coast could participate too without it being too late.
Let me summarize some of the stuff that I heard, and then I want to talk a little bit about the pros and cons of remote versus in person, because what I'm taking from this is, independent of your setup, there are certain things that you got to get right. That every day starts with team time. So everybody generally starts at around the same time. Whether or not you're in person, whether or not you're remote, this is something that you care about because it allows you to perform that psychological exercise of stepping into the circle, right? You know, you spend that time together. Maybe in the case of Gusto, then you split off after a couple hours into pairs to get more work done. But you have that daily team time right at the start.
The splitting off into pairs would happen sooner than as part of team time.
Okay.
So how'd that export thing go? I'm having some trouble with it. Why don't we go work on that now?
Got it. Okay. So you spend that time together at the beginning of the day. At the beginning of each week, you ask yourself this question, what's the most important thing to do this week? And that's independent of what's already listed in whatever type of backlog that you may or may not maintain.
Not your problem.
Yeah, got it. Okay. You end each week with a demo of the stuff that you executed on that week and a little bit of a retro. How'd we do? And how do we want to think about next week in light of how we did?
Nope, that makes not yet.
Oh.
How do we want to think about next week? Monday. Monday is plenty of time to think about that. We have a weekend. We are resting. That is a thing you do as a programmer, is rest. And you can be good at it or you can suck at it. And I have in my life done both.
Sure. Okay, so the Friday conversation then is really just retrospective.
Yep. And then you close the books on the week.
Got it. Let's talk about the pros and cons of remote versus in-person. I want to actually read a quote from an article that paints this picture well. There's so much value in that lunchroom conversation that a junior begins by sitting in on and gradually becomes a confident contributor too. How's that going to happen in a remote world? That worries me. Issues I'm not worried about are executing software projects or even executing cross-functional projects in a remote world. So I read that as a quote that you said. Love for you to expand on that a little bit. Where do you see remote work falling down versus excelling?
I think that it can, doesn't necessarily always do. We had, on this team that I'm talking about, Augusta, we had probably 5 juniors and 6 or 7 seniors. And we took good care of our juniors. I saw the difference in their skills and confidence over the time that we were together. I think it's even more important to have a teaching learning attitude remotely, because you can slip on that. If you're sitting together and somebody goes, huh? And you're the least bit sensitive to that, you'll go, oh, ask that as a question. Use your words, please. And then be able to explain, okay, this is where you are. Here's the explanation. Demonstrate that you understand what I just said. If you're local, that's much easier to do. It takes more of a concerted effort to do that if you're remote. We made that effort. The seniors took the responsibility for not just producing the functionality that we needed, but also teaching the juniors in the process. So that Monday morning sign-up activity is a learning opportunity. Somebody says, I want to sign up for the data export. And you're like, okay, all right, go for it. If you need a pairing partner, I'll pair with you to get that started, or if you have performance problems or whatever. But that also took energy on my part, because I would have loved to have freaked out and yelled at people and told them they weren't going fast enough and blah, 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 blah. In fact, the team killed the project. They were fantastic. And no, it was not as fast as somebody who wasn't involved in all the details thought it should be, but their opinion on that does not matter.
The way that quote's worded and the way I've heard you talk about some of the stuff in the past, it does sound like there's a part of you that maybe worries about what this can mean for the next generation of developers. And so I wanted to pick at that a little bit to better understand your perspective. What worries you the most about remote work and the fact that it's much more prevalent today, if anything at all?
I was the beneficiary of sitting next to one of the great programmers of the 20th century in Ward Cunningham, who could just perform social magic with 10 lines of code. And I got to sit next to him and program with him on the regular, which meant at first, if you touch my keyboard, I'll break your fingers. But eventually I became useful as a syntax, you know, catching parentheses that didn't balance or periods that were misplaced. And then we'd have conversations, and then eventually I got to type a little bit, and then our discussions went higher and higher level, which gives you more and more leverage as you do that. Talking to my dad was a programmer, electrical engineer, way back when, 60s, 70s. That kind of generational teaching was very prevalent. You were just expected, if you were a senior engineer, you were expected that you were going to bring the juniors along. And yes, they're annoying and they don't know anything and they're wet behind the ears. And sometimes it was not a healthy relationship, but that was just part of what senior engineers do. And we seem to have lost that in this mania for productivity, which doesn't mean productivity, but that's a whole nother rant. You know, if those really, really experienced people aren't typing, they're wasting their time. It's bad for the person. It's bad for the team. It's bad for the juniors. It's bad for our profession to have that kind of attitude. I spent almost my entire time at Facebook bucking that by running a coaching program where I coached people and I matched up senior engineers with junior engineers for coaching engagements, which was my attempt to recreate that kind of generational education where you learn engineering instead of just programming. And continue to do that kind of activity. It's interesting. It's hard to get it valued at what it's actually valued. In terms of ROI, you've got some technical ladder and you could hire somebody at the next higher level, or you could get somebody a promotion to go to that level. Getting somebody a promotion is so much cheaper than hiring somebody in. And that happens quite regularly with coaching, but nobody's going to pay any teensy weensy fraction of the cost difference. You know, the place like Meta or Google, that might be worth $200,000-$400,000. Nobody's going to pay 10% of that for coaching that will help accelerate that process.
So if folks aren't willing to pay that, independent of whether or not you're in person or remote, you got to find other ways to get that with the people that you already work with. That it's easier to get that when you can do what you did with Ward, right? When you can sit next to each other physically and, you know, be there linter ostensibly for things.
Tools like Tuple, which ease the friction to real-time collaboration between engineers. That's the real learning accelerator. Yes, you can get a tiny little slice of this through code reviews. Maybe, maybe not. But real time, if we're having a conversation and I'm a senior, you're a junior, and I take responsibility for creating a learning environment for you, not for, you know, shut up, kid, just watch me program fast, but I'm creating a learning environment for you, and this is the best that I know how to do this right now. If I do that and we're pairing, you're going to grow fast. And the team is going to accomplish more in 6 months than if I said, oh, you're just a junior, you know, step aside little lady and, you know, watch the master at work. Which is kind of what we're incentivized. Senior engineers are now incentivized to behave that way, which I think is just a travesty.
If that's the state of the industry today, how do you feel about where we're headed?
Well, how are we going to learn the real difficult lessons? Like ethics. How do you learn ethics except situationally talking to somebody who's been through this before? Like, yes, they ask us to implement this and we are not going to do it. And here's why. And if I get fired because of this, that is one of the outcomes and I'm willing to accept that because there's more important things than this employer. How are you going to learn that except situated? Take some ethics class online? No, that's not how we're exposed to these problems in the first place.
Feels like a pretty pessimistic view on the future.
No, why? We can choose. The first thing to do is just becoming aware of, okay, there are those forces. There are those incentives in place. Doesn't mean I have to follow them. I have other incentives too. I care about my community. And how can I contribute to it? And how can I contribute to its long-term health? Here's the good news about all these juniors coming in. We got this pyramid. We get a new base of the pyramid. And it's way bigger than the pyramid ever was before. What that means is you don't have to convince anybody senior about anything to have impact. Because they're all going to be dead soon. The juniors, if you can convince the juniors that test-driven development and the way that feels is just the way programming ought to be, then pretty soon all the seniors who hate TDD for whatever reason, they're gone. And the juniors have become the seniors, and that's the new norm. I think I'm optimistic. I want to reach the next generation of programmers with this vision of programming as a place where you can feel collegial, you have a place you can belong without losing yourself, without being exploited, where you can do important work, where you can feel significant. Every Friday you get to go home and go, I did something that made Jack's life better. And I feel good about that. So I'm going to sleep well this weekend, so that Monday morning I can come in and just kick it. And I know that the changes that I made Friday went into production and there were no problems, because there almost never are problems. That's possible. If we can reach the juniors with that message of that whole complex, it's not a simple thing. It's not easy, but it is not rocket science to live. And this is, we call this the forest. My oldest, Beth Andriesbeck, and I work on this sense of you're living where there's enough resources to go around. It's not abundance. It's not just gold lying on the floor, but there's enough time. So how would you work if you had enough time? Would you refactor? Sure, because I have enough time. Oh, that makes you go faster tomorrow. Ha! Would I write tests? Sure. Would I redesign things so that it's easier to write better tests? Sure, of course I'd do that. Would I help somebody else who was stuck or where I knew something that they were ready to learn? Sure, of course I would do that because there's enough time in the forest. Now, there's this other ethos, you know, and Musk and Twitter is a great exemplar of that. Let's cut resources as far as possible and see if we can still accomplish anything at all. And that's what we call the desert. And you're in the desert. It's a self-consistent world. And I'm not dissing the desert. It's amazing that people get anything at all done when they have no time, no skills, no purpose, no management, no support, no hope, and they still are insanely profitable as programmers. Wow, that's great that you can do that in the desert, and I don't want to live there. I want to tell the juniors there is this other place. It's hard to get to, is easy to lose it, but it's not impossible to get to, and it's possible to sustain it where there's enough. And you program like there's enough, and then there's even more.
How do you reach people with that message when the incentives aren't aligned to do so, and there's added social friction between that happening, given the fact that so many folks are remote?
I don't think remote really makes a huge difference in the forest and the desert. I think you can create that forest feeling fully remote. We did it at Gusto. I think you can create that feeling and then spread it. And the places that it has spread, it's stuck. But then one person can come in and wreck it, you know, and you say, so one of the things that you see in the forest is you never plan for more than half of what you think you can accomplish. Never. Why would you do that? You know that's not going to happen. Why would you plan for it? So along comes somebody from the desert, and they look at that, and they say, oh, I know how to make this team go twice as fast. They are sandbagging their estimates. They are accomplishing what they say they're going to do every week. Is that a bad thing? In the desert, that statement makes sense. In the forest, that statement makes absolutely no sense. So we're just going to fill up every week on Monday, and then we'll get twice as much accomplished because we have twice as much planned. No, the way you would get twice as much accomplished is by accomplishing twice as much. Not planning twice as much. You know, that one person coming in, though, can ruin the forest. And then the finger pointing starts and people aren't helping other people. And then people are, you know, there's all these weird behaviors that you see, like, any place with a performance review cycle, people are submitting the last month of the performance review cycle. You get 10 times as much functionality as you did in the previous 5 months. That cannot be good. You're thrashing the system. It's crashing all the time, which slows everybody down. You get this flood of new features. Users are overwhelmed by that.
What does better look like?
Well, do some every month. This is not complicated, but to do some every month, you'd have to change the way that you reviewed performance. Ooh, now we're getting in. It's also not complicated, but it's not easy, because that means HR has to be on board, and HR has their own incentives. That means the managers have to be on board. Managers have their own incentives. You just have to decide that you're not going to accept life in the desert, and then you have to start planting the grasses. You can't plant trees first. Trees in the desert are going to die. Grasses carefully tended, they can last for a while. And then you can plant a few shrubs. Then you get some insects. And then you get some birds to eat the insects. And then you get some rodents. And they'll aerate the soil. And now you can have a little bit bigger shrub. You know, it can happen. It's going to take some time. But as we pointed out earlier, it takes a whole lot less time than not doing it at all. Telling the next generation of programmers that there is this place they can be, and then laying out that kind of succession to achieve it little by little, that's the best that I know how to do to encourage this kind of change.
What are some examples of planting the grass and tending the grass? Because I'm imagining there's a lot of folks in our audience who are living in the desert. What advice would you offer them?
Let's start writing tests. That's going to teach you, though, that your software design skills aren't what they need to be to design software that's easy to test. So that's a skill you're going to have to learn. But you can't really learn that until you've written a few tests. So now you're designing, and now you're getting pushback from your teammates because the designs don't look the way they used to look. Now you have a relationship problem. Work on the relationship problem. Start pulling people in. Start talking about what you're trying to accomplish. Talk about what your experience is. Talk about how it used to feel and how it does feel. There's an exercise I used to do, origami, folding paper cranes.
Yeah, of course.
So I would hand out origami paper and those inscrutable folding directions. Mm. You know, that are all pictorial with numbers in the air.
Yeah.
And I'd say, okay, everybody fold something. Here's your instructions and here's your paper. And they would get started and rah, 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 rah. And, you know, 5 minutes and then 3 minutes and then, huh. And I say, all right. And, you know, it was rare. Everyone, you know, I tried this once in Japan and everybody just finished it and it ruined the entire, never again. But if people aren't used to it, it works well. Then I say, all right, new rules. I'm going to hand out a piece of paper and instructions for different. This is a different, roughly similar, maybe a little more complicated thing. And the rule is you get to make one fold and then you hand the paper to the other person. And then they make one fold and they hand it back to you. Everybody finishes. I say, all right. So here's the reflection exercise. Give me two contrasting words. One, how that felt doing that solo, and one, how it felt when you had a partner to do it. People would say, you know, frustrating and satisfying and blah, 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 blah. And then you read down the columns. You say, do you want software development that's like this? Frustrating, slow, anxious. Or do you want software development that's like this? I loved that exercise. It's the quickest way. You know, you want executives not to say, I know how to make this go twice as fast. We'll have everybody typing at the same time. If you want to avoid that, this origami exercise, it just lights people up. Oh, that's what you mean. You're folding, and I'm thinking, huh, is this the right fold? I'm going to catch your errors much more quickly. And what happens next? Let me think through what happens next before I actually have something in my hand. Okay, now I have it. The roles reverse. And then now you're thinking about, oh, is that what that instruction says? Where are we going with this? Let me look at the whole thing. Let me look at the other side of the, okay. And then you get the paper back and then you're focused and centered and you know what you're going to do. That's what programming can feel like. And you'll get more done. Learn faster. That's the forest. That sense of, all right, we're here for each other. Now, it's a gut check for the leaders. What if that's not going fast enough? Well, going slower is not going to go faster. You can pretend to go faster, but you're actually accomplishing less.
Well, yeah, so to play devil's advocate on that, if I may, the leaders aren't stupid, and I don't think you think that they're stupid either. I've heard you talk about this before. Why do you think leaders tend to nudge people towards the desert?
leaders oftentimes aren't living there themselves. They're not living in the forest. They're in a desert. They're in a slugging match. You know, the CTO's in a slugging match with the CFO, with the COO, with the CMO. That's a desert. They just bring that pain, those negative emotions, unprocessed, directly to the team. There's another part of it which is around expressing purpose at this level is not easy. Coming up with the here's what we're here for, that's really hard work. To the moon and return safely in this decade, it's hard to come up with something that pithy, but it's absolutely necessary to be in the forest to have that kind of a here's what we're here for. And it kind of doesn't matter what the here's what we're, as long as it's clear. You know, if you work at a hedge fund and we're here to get massive bonuses at the end of the year, okay, I know what the rules are. I know what to optimize for. I know what not to expect. If we're here to create positive social change, and that's real and it's true, and this isn't just a gloss that we put over our ability to suck resources out of our community, then yeah, let's say that's what we're doing and then let's actually do it.
It sounds like you're speaking to some personal experiences.
Oh yeah. Even expressing it in terms of the forest and the desert is one of those. This is our purpose. We intend to live in the forest where there are sufficient resources as a way of helping us thrive.
Yeah. We've sort of taken it as a foregone conclusion that the forest is better both for the people participating in it, which seems obvious for the reasons you've described, but also for the business as a whole. And that piece seems maybe more contentious. Could you just explain directly why the forest is actually better for the business in terms that somebody could maybe repeat?
The functionality that you get out of desert development is crumbs, is little increments or big increments with huge costs and huge risk that maybe nobody even cares about at all. But you get these little crumbs. What you don't get is what software and geeks together are good at, which is creative leverage. So those moments when you and I were talking, it's Friday afternoon, and you're like, oh, I wish I could just have a feature like blah, blah, blah. And I just happened to have been working on something similar. And I say, oh, Jack, you know what? I'm going to have that tea on Wednesday. You're like, what? I thought that was going to be months of work. That's the cake. It's where desire and capability come together in a creative way to make big leaps at small cost. That's what you can do in the forest that you'll never do in the desert, because in the desert, you're desperate to find the next crumb, because if you don't find it, you're out.
In the desert, by nature, because you're so resource constrained, you're constantly scrambling for the next meal, right? You're scrambling for the crumbs that you can deliver to just skate by, which prevents you from having the time to even have the conversation on a Friday afternoon where desire can meet capability and creative leverage is created, where that person who's got this idea encounters the person who can execute on it much faster than anyone expected.
Yes. You're choosing to let go of all the cakes so that you get this endless stream of crumbs.
It's interesting because when you first started describing the endless stream of crumbs, it felt like a description for continuous delivery in a way where you're, you know, making these small changes incrementally constantly. And I was thinking, where is Ken going with this? Because this actually sounds like this other thing I'm pretty confident you believe in quite a bit.
Very much. I want a slice of cake every week and I want a whole cake every once in a while.
Ken, what's one thing that you hope listeners take away from this conversation?
I'm not sure that's mine to decide. We've talked about a bunch of stuff. Some, it'll hit different people differently. Good luck.
Fair enough. An uncommon answer. Most folks have a specific takeaway. I like the fact that you're leaving it up to us or the listener to take from this conversation what they will and use it how they might. And so with that, I just want to say thank you, Kent, for being generous with your time and perspective. Loved having you on and having this conversation. Hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thanks so much, Jack.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @TupleOnX or visit distributed.fm.